This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, August 1st. I'm Verna Avery Brown. In the House today, environmentalists dig in their heels in opposition to the Bush energy plan. The U.S. wants to skip out on the World Conference Against Racism. And Henry Kissinger has been summoned to Chile to tell what he knows about the death of an American filmmaker. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. A new proposal is heading to Northern Ireland today after weeks of meetings negotiating peace and promises for the troubled region. Anastasia Kershaw reports from the UK.
The British and Irish governments today presented fresh proposals to rescue the Good Friday Agreement while maintaining that decommissioning is key to success. Britain's Northern Ireland office says seven copies were sent by courier and fax to all parties. Measures range from reducing the number of troops. Paramilitaries on the run can return home without facing charges, and there will be new police funds helping the families of officers killed by terrorists. On the critical issue of decommissioning weapons, the government made clear that it is essential to the treaty, with all parties working towards it. The deadline for accepting the plan is Monday. This is Anastasia Kershaw calling from the UK from Free Speech Radio News.
South Africa is about to open its first indie media center. Naeem Jenna reports from Johannesburg.
The indie media movement that has characterized recent international meetings and protests associated with them is coming to South Africa. While some media workers have been discussing ideas around the formation of an indie media type network in South Africa, the imminent World Conference Against Racism has provided the impetus for that to happen. Preparations are at an initial stage. However, media people from various NGOs and community organizations have been meeting to put the structure into operation before the conference later this month. The plan is to set up a media center during the conference and the NGO forum, which will facilitate and enhance the voices of communities, the alternative voices, being heard by the world. The Indie Media crew will organize media conferences for the protesters and communities, link up spokespersons with the appropriate media people, write up stories to be distributed to the media, and file in text and audiovisual stories through a website. Apart from this, they will also produce a hard-hitting newspaper to be distributed to delegates as they arrive at the airport. They will also assist the efforts of refugee communities who will be producing a daily newspaper for the conference called The New Africans. Activists involved with the new initiative believe they will help ensure that the authentic voices of particularly marginalized people will be heard. The initiative plans to continue beyond the racism conference and to affiliate to the International Indie Media Project. Naeem Jina in Johannesburg for Free Speech Radio News.
The Center for Reproductive Law and Policy announced today that it will appeal a judge's ruling to dismiss its lawsuit challenging President Bush's decision to reinstate what abortion rights advocates call the global gag rule. Miranda Kennedy reports from New York.
The so-called Mexico City policy was first instated by President Reagan and prohibits the use of U.S. monies to U.S. family planning groups if they in any way support abortion. The rule also prohibits international groups from using their own funds to provide abortions or abortion counseling, even if the procedure is legal in their country. It forbids foreign NGOs from lobbying or advocating for abortion law reform. The reproductive rights group sued Bush in June on the basis that the policy censored people who advocate abortion rights, but not those who are opposed to abortion. There are no restrictions on anti-abortion groups working abroad. On Tuesday, a Manhattan district judge threw out the suit, saying the claims on free speech were not concrete, but conjectural. But the group says they remain convinced that the censorship of Americans is unconstitutional. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Miranda Kennedy in New York.
And finally, Colombian officials traveled to D.C. to ask the U.S. government to stop fumigating fields in their country. Vanita Naya reports from D.C.
In a news conference, Colombian officials urged Congress to end aerial fumigation of their drug crops because of hazardous effects on both the environment and human health. The $1.3 billion program, known as Plan Colombia, was ordered to be shut down by a Bogota judge, but resumed after a mere one-week hiatus. Colombia's counter-narcotics police and U.S. officials view fumigation, coupled with military assistance and alternative development vegetation, as the only way to stop the drug export. Despite this probability, bills to stop it have been introduced in both houses of the Colombian Congress, and the United Nations has deemed it inhumane and ineffective. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Vanita Nair.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The House of Representatives begins debate today on President George W. Bush's energy plan. Among its provisions, the plan would give more than $30 billion in subsidies to oil, coal, and nuclear companies. It also opens up the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. Bush's legislation received new fuel yesterday from an unlikely source when the AFL-CIO endorsed the president's plan. In a letter from William Samuel, the union's director of legislation, the union said the AFL-CIO has long supported the development of appropriate energy sources. But when the Teamsters Union and Building and Seafarers Unions voiced support for Arctic drilling, the AFL-CIO remained neutral. But a number of environmentalists vehemently oppose the legislation, as we hear in this report from Cotta Mester in Sacramento.
The Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society unveiled a pockmarked map of the United States, illustrating how Bush's energy plan could threaten the health of millions of Americans. Eric Wesselman, regional energy representative for the Sierra Club, says the Bush energy plan calls for at least 1,300 new power plants, while increasing production at nearly 100 existing nuclear reactors.
This is a visual interpretation of what our country could look like if the Bush energy plan was to be put into practice. As you can see, it looks like the country got a bad case of the chicken pox. In reality, it's much worse than that. Unfortunately, it looks like our country actually has a bad case of the fossil blues. Each red dot on this map represents a power plant, a new fossil fuel-fired power plant. The Bush energy plan calls for the completion of 1,300 power plants over the next 19 years. And that would look like this, conceivably. It's impossible to figure out where all these power plants would go. It would literally litter our countryside with hundreds and hundreds of power plants powered by fossil fuels.
Bush says his energy plan aims to reduce dependence on foreign sources of fossil fuels. Currently, there are 55,000 oil and gas wells producing on United States soil. But environmental groups argue that the Bush energy agenda sacrifices air quality and would destroy valuable habitats. Dan Smith, assistant regional director for the Wilderness Society, says the Bush energy plan is one-sided, lacking strategies for energy conservation.
The Bush energy plan really looks at a drill America's wildlands first policy. It does not look at a more comprehensive conservation-based model. So the potential that we would lose spectacular areas if this bill were to pass are very high. And the crown jewel of that is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which is directly mentioned and on the chopping block if this bill were to pass.
According to the U.S. Geological Survey, there are only 6 months of oil available under the Alaskan National Wildlife Refuge. The Bush Energy Plan proposes tapping into 19 other protected habitats in the United States. In California, the federal government could override a moratorium on drilling off the central coast of California. The Caruso National Monument near Bakersfield is another target. It has the highest concentration of endangered wildlife in the country, supporting the California condor and the Swainson hawk. Cheryl Cook of the Lindsay Wildlife Museum.
All animals have, plants, animals, insects, have a place in the ecosystem. And in each one of these animals has a unique niche. And without any one animal, there would potentially be problems for other species, not to mention for humans. Bats, for example, are extremely important in insect, particularly mosquito control. That's one of their favorite food sources, and as you probably know, mosquitoes are one of the most dangerous insects to human species in terms of disease transmission.
The Sierra Club and the Wilderness Society cite a Department of Energy study showing the nation could avoid the need for over 600 of the new power plants. Eric Wesselman of the Sierra Club.
I'm not saying that all oil and gas drilling, we're dependent on some fossil fuel resources for electricity, for vehicles. We're not saying that we should just, you know, go back to the days of get rid of the internal combustion engine. But what we are saying is we ought not drill and destroy our public wildlands, our nation's most precious public lands. And we don't need to because there are other solutions that are quicker, cleaner, cheaper, and safer, like raising corporate average fuel economy standards.
Environmental organizations say the federal government has not pushed for higher fuel efficiency standards in vehicles for over 15 years. They say a national energy plan incorporating such standards would save billions of barrels of oil.
For Free Speech Radio News in Sacramento, I'm Cuta Mester.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is urging world leaders to find common ground on Zionism and slavery reparations, the two issues that could lead to a U.S. boycott of the upcoming World Conference Against Racism in South Africa. Speaking at the National Urban League Conference in Washington, Annan appeared to back the U.S. stance on the conference. Last week, the Bush administration threatened to boycott the conference if organizers insisted on bringing up slavery reparations and a resolution equating Zionism with racism. Human Rights Watch, meanwhile, called on the Bush administration to support the racism conference, saying the government cannot expect to influence debate on the issue by sitting on the sidelines. Susan Wood reports from the United Nations.
The Bush administration has said it will not attend the World Conference Against Racism if proposals equating Zionism with racism and calling for reparations for slavery and colonialism are included in the conference agenda. U.S. diplomats attending a two-week preparatory meeting in Geneva are reportedly making strenuous efforts to get African and Arab nations to agree to drop those demands. Meanwhile, U.S. civil rights organizations and members of the Congressional Black Caucus are urging the administration to signal its commitment to fighting racism by supporting the conference, while Jewish lawmakers and others are firmly opposed. Yesterday, a U.S. congressional subcommittee discussed the upcoming conference. Congressperson Cynthia McKinney attacked President Bush for what she called his indifference to racism.
Given that 30% of the U.S. population consists of people of color and that we all have experienced racism firsthand, I have to wonder if the Bush administration's position on the wicker is just politically dumb or if it is perhaps indicative of something more malignant. We can all understand political naivete. However, these Bush folks got together and conspired to deprive blacks in Florida of their right to vote. Naivete is not one of their more prominent characteristics. I'm compelled to ask the obvious question, then, that no one will ask. Is the Bush White House just full of latent racists? Could it be that the Bush administration's opposition to participating in the World Conference flows naturally from his own campaign trail? We all remember the Bush presidential campaign.
Yet another member of the committee, Tom Lantos, said that as a Holocaust survivor, he is deeply concerned that the Bush administration would even consider going to a conference which would discuss the issue of Zionism as racism.
That it is inappropriate for the United States, the global champion for human rights with all of our failings, to be part of a lynch mob in Durban, which will luxuriate in bashing one country, one people.
Top UN officials appear to be siding with the Bush administration's stance that a focus on divisive issues will wreck the conference. On Monday, Secretary General Kofi Annan addressed the annual conference of the National Urban League, one of the nation's oldest and more conservative civil rights organizations, calling for unity.
The months leading up to the conference have opened up deep fissures on a number of sensitive issues, such as the legacy of slavery and colonialism and the situation in the Middle East. If this conference is to succeed, there is an acute need for common ground. The conference must help heal old wounds without reopening them. It must confront the past, but most importantly, it must help set a new course against racism in the future.
Also on Monday, Mary Robinson, UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, speaking at the opening meeting of the preparatory committee, agreed that reopening the issue of Zionism as racism would endanger the conference. While expressing dismay at the toll of deaths and injuries among Palestinians in the territories occupied by Israel, Robinson said that the UN General Assembly had repealed a resolution to that effect a decade ago. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Susan Wood at the United Nations.
Chile's Supreme Court has authorized an investigating judge to submit questions to former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger about the assassination of an American filmmaker during General Augusto Pinochet's rule. Judge Juan Guzman, who sought unsuccessfully to try Pinochet on human rights charges, wants to question Kissinger as part of his probe into the death of Charles Horman. The filmmaker was shot and killed by police in Santiago's soccer stadium shortly after the dictator toppled democratically elected President Salvador Allende in a U.S.-backed military coup. Aaron Glantz has the story.
Charles, with a friend of ours, was trapped in Viña del Mar when the coup happened in Chile in September 1973. And he came to meet some U.S. Navy officials who were taking credit for and being very proud of the smooth operation of the coup. My husband, as a journalist, realized that they were there illegally, undercover, and this was dangerous information.
Joyce Horman is the widow of Charles Horman, an American journalist who was forced into a soccer stadium and shot dead by troops loyal to Chilean General Augusto Pinochet shortly after he seized power in a U.S.-backed coup in 1973.
I think there was an exchange of a great deal of information, and I think the fact that Charles Horman, as a journalist, was privy to the opinions and the enthusiasm of U.S. Navy personnel in Viña del Mar had and influenced his future and his death. And I believe that in order to get a full picture of exactly what happened, these questions have to be asked at the highest level.
The 17 questions posed to Henry Kissinger by the Chilean judge Juan Guzman and permitted by the High Court of Chile are the result of a criminal lawsuit filed by Joyce Horman. Kissinger was President Nixon's national security advisor from 1969 to 1973 and Secretary of State from 1973 to 1997. Larry Burns is director of the Washington-based Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
General Pinochet knew that there would be no adverse reaction in Washington to an overthrow of the constitutional president of Chile. And several years later, when Ambassador Lando, U.S. ambassador to Chile, sort of sternly rebuked the Pinochet regime for its human rights violations, and in a telex to the State Department, to Secretary of State Kissinger, he mentioned what he had said to Pinochet. Kissinger wired back that we're not interested in political science lectures here.
Burns says the human rights abuses ignored or encouraged by Kissinger included a mobile helicopter death unit.
The helicopters would land in the city of Concepcion. Police cars would race up to a house where the victim was living. He'd be seized, maybe a Democratic leader, someone opposed to military. They would seize that person, torture them, and then kill them. And they did, on that particular mission, about 110 people were killed. All told, about 3,000 political prisoners were murdered in Chile. Characteristically, they were tortured. This is what Kissinger described, responded to his ambassador to Santiago when the U.S. ambassador raised the question. In that response to Pinochet, Kissinger said he didn't want a political science lecture.
Kissinger's actions in the Nixon White House have come under increasing scrutiny in recent years. The 17 questions posed to Kissinger by Chile's High Court come on the heels of a book by Christopher Hitchens titled The Trial of Henry Kissinger. At a speaking engagement in San Francisco, Kissinger rebuked those charges.
I don't comment on that article, which is untrue, reckless, and contemptible.
Kissinger also expressed concerns about the evolution of international human rights law.
If this is being used to score cheap political points, and if people do not have the courage to disagree their substance, to state their substance, but turn every dispute into an argument of their opponent being a war criminal, they are undermining the very goal that they are pretending to serve.
Kissinger has not yet commented on the questions posed by Chile's high court, but in May he refused a request by a French judge to answer questions about the disappearances or killings of French citizens under Pinochet. Again, Joyce Horman.
I think that his policies and his actions were very influential in the crimes against humanity that took place in Chile. And I think that he is avoiding answering questions directly because of this culpability. This is my personal opinion, but I believe that the international legal apparatus now to ask questions across borders legally is a very important one, and we're looking to this new jurisdiction, international jurisdiction on human rights, to make advances in providing information to the U.S. government and to all its citizens as to the role that the U.S. government played in the overthrow of democracy in Chile in 1973.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz.
In Peru, almost no one predicted the political changes that would take place between July 2000 to July 2001. This time last year, July 28th to be exact, Alberto Fujimori was taking power for a third term, a dubious win as his police forces brutally suppressed the action of scores of protesters. Last weekend, Alejandro Toledo, leader of the street protests, took command of the country in ceremonies full of pomp and circumstance after winning elections applauded from all sides. Tatiana Harrison reports from Lima.
Witches, get those witches out, shout Toledo supporters at his inauguration speech. The three remaining congresswomen of Fujimori's once powerful party are holding up signs saying, "Fujimori pacified the nation," or DNA, referring to campaign season reports that Toledo had fathered an illegitimate child he refuses to recognize. This year, they are the heckling minority. But last year, Fujimori and his supporters wielded ultimate authority, and their crackdown on Peruvians protesting Fujimori's inauguration day last year turned the center of Lima into a war zone. As tear gas protesters huddle over a puddle of water, the mix of students, housewives, and workers describe that the police have been aiming at bodies using increasing amounts of tear gas that is making people throw up. That day, the networks went live as more than 100 people were arrested, scores injured, including a man who lost his eye, and six people died in a fire, now believed to have been purposely set to discredit the protesters. The country continued feeling the pangs of living under dictatorship until barely a month into his third term, Fujimori's government came crashing down. These are the sounds of what did him in. The image of this video is Fujimori's spy chief, Vladimiro Montesinos, handing over $15,000 to a congressman, paying him to change to Fujimori's party. On the 27th of September, 51 days into his term, Fujimori announced in a dry TV message to the nation that he was calling for new elections. Peruvians partied before the cameras of CNN, tooting their horns and raising their voices. Roughly half of Peruvians supported Fujimori, mostly for the efficient job he'd done ridding the country of hyperinflation and insurgent groups. But those voices were drowned out by the Peruvians who couldn't believe their wildest dreams had come true. Protesters outside the Japanese embassy shout that they will not forget, they will not forgive. Fujimori must go to prison. Fujimori fled to Japan, and it was discovered that he had always held Japanese citizenship, which keeps him safe in a country that has no intention of extraditing him. His spy chief was caught in Venezuela after 238 days on the lam, and a slimmer Montesinos with a mysterious thin smile was ushered into the Palace of Justice to begin answering some of the countless questions Peruvians have about how their country was run for the last 10 years. This Saturday, the president of transition, Valentin Paniagua, triumphantly enters the Cathedral of Lima, hours before handing over the presidential sash to Alejandro Toledo. Paniagua presided over a government who had conducted elections in which Toledo had won fair and square, if by a thin margin. The government also launched hundreds of investigations into corrupt officials and many are already behind bars, including the former attorney general under Fujimori. Toledo, the first Peruvian president with humble roots and indigenous blood, has represented his government as market economics with a human face. Although his cabinet is headed up by big business-friendly ministers, in his inauguration speech, he often referred to himself as a president of the poor. "We will reduce poverty. That is a central task of my government," he says. The day after this speech, he flew to the ancient Incan capital of Cusco to repeat his pledge on the ruins of the mountain citadel of Machu Picchu. Journalist Lucien Chauvin, who has lived in Peru 12 years, says that many grassroots leaders are relying on Toledo's success to ascend the political power structure.
"I think if he fails, people are going to say, see, you know, someone of indigenous heritage isn't capable of running a country."
Toledo faces some high hurdles. While dealing with the pressures to service its $27 billion external debt, the government must respond to Peru's poor, 54% of the population, most of them of indigenous descent, who are crying out for relief and jobs. Julia, 53, is one of those banking on Toledo to improve her lot. Speaking a stone's throw from the pig snouts and cowtails in Cusco's Central Market, she says she was impressed by an outdoor rally Toledo held in Cusco immediately following his Machu Picchu ceremony. But she worries that people will just expect handouts from the new president.
"Como le digo, presidente de los pobres no quiere decir que él venga pues y nos dé todo."
Saying he is president of the poor doesn't mean he comes and gives us everything, she says. If we want him to be a good president, we have to work. That's the only way we can get out of this poverty. Her hope and determination was echoed by the thousands of Peruvians who turned out to watch Monday's military parade. In Lima, Toledo parades by standing in a jeep, giving big waves to his fans. A year ago, Fujimori, reeling from the Inauguration Day chaos, had to hold the parade inside the grounds of the National Intelligence Building. As the parade music swells all around him, Toledo represents something different, and the cheers around him are shouts of hope that it's also something better. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tatiana Harrison in Cusco, Peru.
Free Speech Radio News is a production of Pacifica Reporters Against Censorship. Over 40 reporters on four continents and in 14 states are on strike against Pacifica Network News for its censorship of legitimate news stories. These reporters are putting their livelihoods on the line. They need your support. For more information, go to the strike's website at www.savepacifica.net/strike. This newscast was produced by Aaron Glantz. Headlines editor, Randy Zimmerman. Technical producer, Jade Pageant-Seekins. Technical assistant, Matt Martin. We had web support from Vanessa Tate and Leslie Holmes. This newscast was produced at WMNF Radio in Tampa and the Independent Media Center in New York. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Please tune in again tomorrow for another edition of Free Speech Radio News.